You're listening to Ruining It for Everyone with your hosts Maggie McPhee and Christopher Harrington. Tonight's episode, Game Over, Man! With special guest John Alper. This episode is sponsored by Red Giant Software, makers of kick-ass plugins for post-production. John, welcome back to the show.
And it's a pleasure being here.
Yes, very good to have you back. And of course, the reason we have you back is that they announced the new Mac Pros.
I thought you just missed me.
Well, that too. But it's a really nice excuse to get you on the show again.
Well, thank you.
Yay! Maggie, how are you doing?
I'm well. This is the follow-up to Somebody Wake Up Hicks, which we don't know what that's called, but...
it's episode 27, and you'll know what the title of this show is when
Game
this actually
over,
airs.
Man.
You know, I think you've got it.
I think it could be May the Tube Be With You. That was one of them.
I don't know.
and then in light of all the new software still in testing from WWDC, it could just be another bug hunt.
Right, that could be it.
Oh, yeah, another bug hunt.
There is a lot of that, but I think Game Over is certainly a possibility.
That's probably the OS 10.9 show.
Right. Yeah, which of course I didn't put in the show notes because, quite frankly, I think that's going to warrant its own show. Or maybe not. There does seem to be a lot of fun stuff under the hood, but otherwise it seems to be very status quo. OS 10 seems to be fairly mature, and what is there left? You know, it's clearly not the Wild West like the mobile space is. So, you know, I can't imagine a lot of excitement from users for it versus the excitement that they're going to get with their mobile devices with iOS 7 and all that.
Yeah, until something changes drastically on the hardware side. Yeah, I don't see a lot of change, but who knows?
I think there might be more to it, though. I mean, a couple of thoughts on this. First of all, there's OS 10.9, Sea Lion, or as some people seem to call it as a joke, Mavericks.
Yes.
But I think there are a couple of quick important things to touch on. One, everybody was freaking out that macOS 10 was going to get iOSified, and we were going to lose our command line, and we were going to lose OS 10 server. And, you know, in a lot of ways, what didn't change in Mavericks is really good news.
Yeah. And it seemed, while I wouldn't say that the, quote, you know, hardcore folk, you know, the power users and such were necessarily catered to, I certainly think that there are some things that would definitely, hey, these are power user features. You know, this is decidedly not iOSification. This is bringing it back to, you know, this is a desktop. This is a truck space.
Well, it's still OS 10.
Right.
I mean, honestly, my feeling has always been that they won't make any real serious changes until OS 11 because, A, they're going to feel obligated to do something, and, B, it may be their excuse. Okay, now it's time to, but, you know, I mean, things have crept in. But, I mean, as long as the hardware, the things like laptops and desktops exist, you know, I think we'll have something that's fairly... in what we're used to in to a great degree, but things will creep in. But I don't know. At some point, I think Apple, there's going to be a break somewhere down the road, and I don't know when or where. Like I described to you before, you know, where we have a tiny laptop, maybe a desktop, and everything else is a device. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So, but I think that's pretty still kind of far off.
One of the things that they didn't introduce in the keynote, and which may or may not exist in one of the sessions, they didn't talk about any additional security technologies. For example, like they introduced sandboxing in Lion, right? And that fundamentally changed how applications communicated with each other, meaning that they, in general, they couldn't, right? Unless they had specific permission and da-da-da-da-da. And of course, anything on the Mac App Store had to be sandboxed and had to be, you know, closed off like that. So consequently, there are now apps out there that have different feature sets depending on whether or not you got them from the Mac App Store versus a download directly from the company who made the product. BB Edit is one of them. you can sort of do a separate download for the missing features, but it's still, you know, it's a very different thing. And we didn't see any additional compartmentalizing for security's sake, which is interesting to me. And I'm quite glad, considering I do a lot of automation and I like my apps being able to talk to each other and being scriptable.
Apple's still talking about automation, and our command line is still there, and Automator's still there, and presumably AppleScript is still there. And
oh, barely, I think. AppleScript is not a happy camper.
I was listening, and I thought, oh my God, he's going to say the word Unix. He's going to, no, he didn't. But there was, it's like, through the years, we've been built on the foundation of blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, oh, is he going to mention Unix? No. But,
I don't think they're licensing the Unix name anymore. So I don't know if they are still able to use it. I think they changed that in a few versions ago.
Also, a couple of versions back, things that were, part of the Unix certified thing have gotten a little squishy, like you must do this. And then they did that. And then it got a little squishy afterwards as to whether it's really. So, they got what they want. They got what they need.
Right.
I don't think that's important to them anymore. So and it's fine.
Right. And as John mentions, even though it's not it may not be technically Unix, it's still a proper command line. We still have the ability to compile things.
Right, right.
We have access to GCC. We've got access to better compilers even, the Clang and LLVM are really quite lovely, especially if you're doing native OS X or iOS development, you're required to use them because that's what Xcode uses by default. And they're really quite good, And so this is really nice. This is a good positive thing that's coming out of Apple, which, I was a little bit scared of. I was wondering if they were going to drift too far toward the consumerization device, disposable culture. And I think at least as far as OS X is concerned, my fears seem to be mitigated somewhat. So
the idea that it's a truck is preserved, I think. And I mean, we're all NDA bound, so there's stuff we just can't get into. But they talked about tabbed finder. That's not an iOS-y thing. That's a power user thing. They talked about rethinking multiple monitors. That's not an iOS-y thing. That's not a just the only, that's not a all we care about are the people who buy an iMac and go away. And I would say that the tagging of file information is significant too, because we don't have that soup of My Documents, which is utterly useless for anybody that does anything significant on their machine.
Oh, the thought of that in the first place, the whole My Documents concept was complete crap. If you have more than like 10 documents on your machine, it was totally ridiculous.
Apple has always been more into the metadata, and this is why PC people hate iTunes.
Right.
It's like, well, no, it keeps all the information for you, but I want to put it in folders and it needs to be in a hierarchy and I need to be able to find it. Why? Why do you need to be able to find it?
Right.
And I think it's a great point John brings up about the multiple screens thing. That is a very clear indicator that they are still thinking about the desktop, and I'm going to use the word paradigm, but they're still thinking about that.
Right.
Because those changes were absolutely warranted, and I'm very happy about them.
Right. Unfortunately, it's also, we're getting back to what we had, several years ago.
Right, right. Just in time for the big cataclysm.
It's lovely that we have it, but, we never should have gotten rid of it in the first place.
Hey, look, multicam.
Yeah, hey.
that sort of thing.
I think that's actually one of the things that, speaking of Final Cut Pro 10, I think that is precisely driving, specifically Final Cut Pro 10, is driving the whole multiple monitors need to be able to do something other than just use a single monitor and blank out the others.
Well, and also when you've got apps that are meant to be run full screen too, it's like immediate frustration. They introduce that whole thing, and then apps show up in the app store, and then you make it full screen, and then suddenly you're like, all right, what do I do here? Because you got two screens and something weird goes weird on the other.
I've seen people with full screen emails open. And meanwhile, you know, their line length is like 3,000 characters long, which is, you know, ridiculous.
Or not. It's a giant window with a tiny bit of text jammed up into the left corner of the text window. You know?
Right, which is ridiculous. But at the same time, if you've got an 11-inch Air or even a 13-inch Air with, I mean, they've got paltry, paltry resolutions. Some of these apps now have UIs that are so big that they require being full screen just to make sure that you're not, you know, having to scroll everywhere and do all sorts of stuff. So, like, for example, Mail App, you know, Mail App on the 11-inch Air is really bad. I mean, you have to go full screen.
But there's a difference between filling your screen with a window and going full screen.
I agree, sure.
And my crazy theory with no basis in fact is that the departure of the green felt took with it the thinking behind full screen apps in the sense of full screen. And then and maybe those people with access to the Mavericks beta and the developer program and therefore access to file radars, John Siracusa posted a little movie tweet a while back where he talked about the old behavior of the auto zoom button or whatever it's actually called in Mac OS X as compared to the old days of OS 9. And in the old days, that button would pop the window to show the maximum possible content in the available screen real estate. So it was essentially sort of like a maximize button, but it was a smart maximize.
Right, it was maximized for your content rather than maximize for the space of your monitor.
And at some point in OS X, maybe even with the original Rhapsody release, that functionality went poof. But it is something that we had in Classic that was brilliantly useful, that if people file bugs against it in Mavericks, we could conceivably get back, that would give us the my window fills my screen, but my app is not a full screen app. And more useful as a way of working, because then you move aside the thing you're working on, pick up something from behind what you're working on, and get back to what you were doing.
As a matter of fact, I would actually like better and more powerful ways to manage windows rather than have fewer of them and make me, you know, force me into some sort of monotasking. There are features that I would like to see with regard to dragging and dropping that don't yet exist on, I think, any operating system at the moment.
What we do, all of us, and what I would submit most pro users do, is we think in terms of a tool chain, right? Whereas a typical office or home user thinks in terms of the task and the application they use to do that task. But you don't do graphic design, you don't do, forgive the retro term, multimedia authoring. You don't do app development if you're a one-person shop with one tool. You have a chain of tools that are specialized to do the various pieces that you move your data from one tool to the next, and that's why automation matters so much.
And it's also not a pipeline. You know, it's not going from A to B to C. You may be going from A to B to C back to B or from C to A. And so you need that flexibility where, you know, you can't just be in this mode and then you go into this next mode and you never go back to the prior modes.
Exactly. And essentially what we're all doing is either we're dealing with the tool chain thing where we're round tripping in a non-linear way between the various tools as we iterate what we're working on, or we're making a dashboard. And antithetical to the iOSification of a desktop OS, and much to my great relief in watching the keynote for WWDC, not where Apple took Mavericks. And to me, that's a big, wonderful deal.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to Mavericks. I think, you know, a lot of the new technologies that are sort of under the hood, you know, again, I talked about this being a fairly mature OS. And so we're probably going to have a lot more under the hood, not necessarily user-facing changes. I love what they're doing with regard to power consumption. They have this whole thing where, you know, you can, rather than having the CPU cycle itself on and off and on and off and on and off very quickly, it is grouping those cycles so that everything will run in one fell swoop and then it'll have a longer pause because of the latency and power required to power up and power down the CPU cores. I thought that was actually rather ingenious.
There's definitely good stuff in there. And they shipped a MacBook Air that PC Week did a test on and said they got 15 hours out of for real. And that test wasn't run, as far as I know, on Mavericks. That was run on Mountain Lion.
Yeah, just Mountain Lion with the new Haswell chip. Yeah, and I'm not certain if they changed the milliamp hours in the battery, but it's very clear that the new chip is a better, less power-hungry than the Ivy Bridge predecessor.
So what happens when you combine those technology, those hardware changes, with the software changes in Mavericks? Does your MacBook Air truly become an all-day laptop? Does someone who's really working on it?
Easily.
Yeah, I mean, this stuff is cool. I'm very happy.
Yeah, I'm a little bit curious because it says to me, and this is pure speculation on my part, it says to me that in order to do that, they have to fiddle around with the scheduler. And that is kind of the heart of an OS, right? So an OS is basically a scheduler and a memory manager. So how I'm curious as to the types of apps, the higher-end apps that we run, whether it's Adobe Creative Suite or, you know, a 3D tool like Maya or Nuke or Smoke or what have you, I'm wondering if they will cooperate in the same way or if we'll actually wind up seeing a speed decrease, you know, because of the changes in the scheduler.
I mean, you and I kicked this around in Twitter. Does what you move to the foreground essentially put a GUI on re-nicing things?
Sort of automatically, right.
And I don't know the answer either, and that'll be fun stuff to find out. And I suspect that if the result is the one we like, which is that when we absolutely positively have to have it render overnight, we can manually via the necessary sacrificing of rubber chickens force the cycles to be where we want them, and it could be a beautiful thing.
It's like the energy saver system preference, the system pane,
right,
today,
right, exactly,
where you know you basically have your on battery spec, and then you have your on mains power spec, where you've got, you know, oh, I don't want my hard drive to ever spin down because it's a spinny disk and having it spin up and down is actually wear and tear on the drive. Best to keep it spinning full time, you know, versus I'm on battery.
Right. Or if you have the multi-mode graphics where you can say, I want higher graphics performance or I want better battery life. You know?
Right. Yeah. And that's one of the things as well, because they never quite got the automatic happy switching thing working, especially with like the Retina MacBook Pros, switching from the internal graphics to the, actually with any of them really, switching from the internal graphics to the discrete graphics card has always been a little bit weird, because things that you'd never think would get or would require a GPU would suddenly kick it on, and they still haven't quite solved that.
You have heard of the third-party tool GFX card status, yes?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I have heard of it, but of course, I don't bother using it because my laptop actually doesn't have a discrete graphics card, so it's kind of moot.
I am blessed with both, and I find that tool incredibly useful, and it returned to me the control that we lost and works around the wonkiness that you described.
Oh, very nice.
And I would suspect, though I don't know, that if we run into similar kinds of challenges in Mavericks, that we'll see similar kinds of highly specialized third-party widgets. GFX card status is, if for those who haven't heard of it, is a very handy tool if you want to grab and control which of the, whether it's the on-CPU GPU or a dedicated GPU, drives your laptop display.
That's very cool. Yeah, we'll definitely put that in the show notes. One of the things that also interested me in Mavericks was they Sherlocked the hell out of a lot of different companies.
Sherlock is back.
Oh, God. Yeah. Holy crap. I think there were at least like, I was counting while I was originally watching the keynote. I didn't bother counting the second time I watched the keynote. But it seemed to me like there were at least like a dozen different companies that have products that are basically outmoded by the new operating system. You know, that isn't to say that the individual products you know, have additional value, etc. But the overall gist of what they do is now incorporated into the operating system. Of course, that's a risk that everyone takes. You know, you make something really cool. If it's so cool, there's a distinct possibility that Apple is going to copy it. You know, that's just the way shit works. And I don't have a problem with that. But I also thought it was really hilarious that it was so many of them this year.
Yeah. I mean, oh yeah, it does always kind of happen here and there. But I mean, it always really just depends on how well Apple executes too. It's like Dropbox is still alive and kicking.
Exactly. And I think that it comes down to the additional value versus the explicit implementation that Apple provided. So for example, I'm a 1Password user. And I love it. I think it's great. I love the fact that I can have it synchronize all of my passwords on all of my devices locally so that my password file is actually never, quote, in the cloud. No one can steal that from me unless, of course, they physically steal one of my devices. And even then, the file's encrypted. You can't get to it unless you're going to take time to try and, you know, sic a bunch of GPUs on it, and even then it's going to take forever to crack open. So right. I'm not too worried about that. But I am very worried about the Apple implementation of the keychain being synchronized, which is theoretically very cool because now, you know, instead of buying 1Password, which admittedly is pretty expensive because they want you to buy it on every device, God forbid, right? But the way they do it is that it all happens inside iCloud. And as we now know, the government is basically collecting all data from the internet, full stop.
Yeah.
And of course, they would never abuse that.
No.
Why on earth would they abuse that? They have no reason to abuse that.
I am mocked occasionally for my, and I describe this way myself, my tinfoil hattedness about some of these questions. But I don't use the keychain locally either, and I haven't ever.
Really?
Wow. Well, there's probably some things in your keychain because I think they just put that shit there automatically.
Like, well, certificates and stuff.
Absolutely. It's like you can't not use keychain, but you can choose not to store your passwords for websites, et cetera, in your keychain. And I use an external encrypted database for that stuff. For all practical purposes, consider it 1Password, but it's not. And what it is, it doesn't matter because I've changed tools to do it several times. And the reason is that when I log into my Mac, I don't want to unlock everything, right?
Right, sure.
It's not, you know, people will jokingly tease me about my tinfoil hat, but it's really that I don't want the act of logging in to concurrently unlock all the things that I want to password protect.
Right.
And so to me anyway, that 1Password's continued value is that it's another thing that you unlock. And I don't know enough about 1Password as a tool, but theoretically, I bet they could support multiple locked password vaults in a single app so that you could, for example, put your, and you'd have to tell me, Christopher, because you're the user of the tool, but what if you had sort of, you know, this is my 1Password file for my banking applications that I don't sync. This is my 1Password file for this client's disk image files, and this is my 1Password file for that client's disk image files. I just don't like to cross-pollinate the encryption for the different people and clients that I'm responsible to is really what it boils down to. I mean, I joke about the tinfoil hat thing, but that's what it is. I owe them segmentation of how I encrypt, if that makes sense.
Oh, it makes perfect sense. And that's highly logical. Whether or not 1Password does that sort of, automatically, I don't recall.
It doesn't.
It doesn't. Okay. But I do know that you can manually do it.
Yeah, you can create more. Yeah, like I have one for work, I have one for home. And like when you log in, of course, it doesn't just open. And even when you like use it in a browser, it doesn't, you don't unlock 1Password until you unlock 1Password.
Right. So. But once it is unlocked,
so.
So I would submit in the case of the Sherlocking of 1Password, to me, what's happened is just like Time Machine doesn't obviate the need for Super Duper, Apple's keychain sync and improvements of keychain functionality doesn't obviate the need for 1Password or whatever tool you might choose to use.
Right.
And I already have a use case for that, you know, anyway. So I doubt that I'll bother with the iCloud keychain.
And I don't believe personally anyway that the people who are smart enough to buy a product like 1Password are going to suddenly decide they don't need it anymore because of what Apple's done. And to me, the quote Sherlocking of that functionality into Mavericks just means that now people who don't take that level of caution are more likely to have all the convenience and the better security that Mavericks offers. So to me, that's not a case of Sherlocking, but that's me.
Right. I mean, it's Sherlocking for a very common use case, right, where people just need to have an application that stores passwords and, you know, allows you to create long form mishmash, you know, passwords. So it's not just, you know, it has high entropy, right?
Right. It's become something that no one ever asked me about to something that people ask me about occasionally enough that I notice.
Yeah.
I need something to store my passwords. Well, okay. And here's a great thing.
So, yeah, I think Mavericks is going to be really exciting. But also that brings us to the announced Ashcan or donut or cylinder or Darth Vader rejuvenation chamber that is the new Mac Pro. And it's a thing that they brought out.
Yeah.
It's a Pringles can full of snakes.
It is. So if you have been living under a rock and you're finally hearing this, Apple announced a new Mac Pro that is roughly the size of an iPad in cylinder form with one CPU, two fairly nice professional level GPUs, and a single fan, and no internal storage whatsoever, except these SSDs, and those are PCI style SSDs, they're the blade style SSDs, like in the Airs, and a bunch of Thunderbolt ports, and that's it. So backing up a bit, in our last show with John Alper, which was episode 27, Somebody Wake Up Hicks, we discussed the merits of what the next Mac Pro is going to be. And we talked about, well, okay, is it going to be better in the same box? Is it going to be better in a different box? Is it going to be so out of left field that it's entirely useless? So now we've seen it, right? So what are your thoughts?
Well, we can talk about where our predictions diverged and converged with reality, if we like. That's one way to approach this.
Sure. Yeah, let's do that.
Well, for one thing, Maggie, unfortunately, is not going to be making any custom Alper Mac logos.
No, I do not have to acknowledge the Alper.
and I'm disappointed about that. And for those who didn't listen to and who should go back and listen to Somebody Wake Up Hicks episode 27 of Ruining It for Everyone. I'm trying to do my best Christopher here. I had this dream that Apple would meet the needs of many different communities by packaging the next generation Mac Pro in a nominally rack mountable device. And they got as far from that as you can imagine. And I've been sitting here thinking about the new Mac Pro, Darth Mac, or whatever we want to call it, and trying to imagine how to rack mount it. And
well, you don't. You buy a wine rack.
Well, see, that's the thing. You can't buy a wine rack because the cooling process is a mixture of that single fan at the top and convection.
Right.
So.
Yeah. So you buy a shelf.
No, you buy. No, even better. Even better. You buy a wine fridge.
So, I mean, theoretically, someone could design enclosures that would allow you to put these up like wine bottles in a rack and, you know, do enough forced air movement to overcome the loss of the convection process in these. You could do it. But, you know, even since the bulgy-sided, you know, G3 tower, this is the least rack-mountable non-iMac Mac Apple's made in forever, and that bums me out some.
Well, it in a way, it is very iMac in that regard, in that it's the iMac without the screen in a round case. You know,
well, I was thinking more Mac Mini. But I think that is it. You know, it's definitely the, we're going to make this as small as humanly possible, but still provide the power we think it needs to provide.
Right. And we are going to jam two graphics cards in there.
But let's, for lack of a better cliche to use, give the devil his due here a bit on this too. One of the problems that we've all had, if we've ever set up production environments, is silencing the machines. And so lots of companies have made these enclosures with built-in silencing, or we put a machine room off the edit suite. There's reason to hope we won't need to be doing that with the new Mac Pro.
I'm very curious about that as well. I think you're right. But I also think that a single fan, if you've got something rendering, you've got two very high-end professional graphics cards jammed in with a new Xeon part that has a top-dead power of, what, 130 watts? That's going to get really toasty. I can see that fan being very hummy.
I don't know how they do that, because that's got to be a fair amount of wattage to drive. Well, just one Xeon, but you've got to drive these two cards as well. And we all know that GPUs are power hungry. GPUs that can have up to, you know, 12 gigabytes of RAM total are very, very power hungry.
Well, actually, I think it's only up to six.
It's six per card, according to my friend Mitch.
Well, that's the whole thing. It's ambiguously worded on the site itself, where it says up to 6 gigabytes, but they're talking about it as the pair of cards. So it's entirely possible that it's 3 and 3. But still, yeah, if it is six per, we're talking a lot of heat, but it's also possible that they're actually underclocking, or they're using a card that isn't like a 10,000 series or even a 9,000 series. Maybe they're using a lower-end GPU.
I don't think they're going to chance that, but again, we're still in the land of speculation. But it's important to remember a couple of other quick things about this. One, when you're dealing with a desk, like my cheese grater here, you have a PCI card with a heatsink with constrained volume, and in constrained volume, constrained airflow, and you're moving air over it perpendicular to the natural flow of air off something that gets hot. Whereas one of the things that's interesting about the Mac Pro is that all of the heat-producing stuff in it is mechanically connected to this rather massive triangular heatsink that runs up completely empty, by the way, through the core of the device.
Yeah, it's really ingenious. The design of it is fantastic.
And the convection alone is moving a significant amount of air over the heatsink surfaces. And because so much of the volume of this 6-and-some-odd-inch diameter cube is air around this central thermal core, you know, I'm not this kind of engineer by a long shot, but that looks like some serious natural heat dissipation to me. So I think it's dangerous to jump to too many conclusions about how much they would have to wussify the GPUs.
Well, they clearly went with a custom build of the GPU, so that I'm sure that makes a lot of difference.
All of this is very custom.
Some very serious thermal engineering has gone on, and I fully expected it will work because, you know, I mean, I had a G4 Cube, and everyone's like, "Oh my God, it's a jillion watts! It'll never be," and it worked, you know. And it didn't have a fan. This has fans as well, so I feel confident that they won't release something that's underdone just to make that work. But then there's still the question of how loud the fan is, like you said.
Right. But I think also, they're using the same fan technique that they're using in the modern Mac laptops as well, where they are, you know, slightly changing. The fans are all asymmetric, so at least when it's whining, it's not going to be an annoying high-pitched whine. It's going to be more of a white noise type of whine, which is better anyway on some level. But
right, or a deep throaty kind of thing.
I'm thinking Maserati Bora kind of sound.
That would be fabulous.
As long as you don't totally walk away.
Right.
Like Emilio Lizardo did.
Oh, dear. But but it's also one of the reasons why we're not seeing dual CPU configurations in this as well. There's no possible way a single fan of in an enclosure that size could deal with the heat produced by two 12-core Xeons at full blast plus two, again, you know, professional-level GPUs
at max. Then they might have to make it bigger, and this is Apple we're talking
right,
about.
Exactly.
Heaven forfend, right. We changed the size.
And
we shaved off 3/4 of an inch.
But we do have a 12-core single CPU.
Right, right, which is really lovely.
We at least have comparable performance.
But at the same time, you know, this part is, you know, it's not a custom part where no one else has 12 cores. It's like, no, everyone else has 12 cores. And if I recall correctly, I thought I saw in the Intel timeline that the high end of the Xeons have upwards of 16 cores. So if you...
Yeah, there's supposed to be another chip in that same series that will have 16 cores.
Right. So if you have a massively parallel CPU-bound problem, you know, more cores equals more betterer. And if you can shove another CPU in there with another 16 cores, you are now blowing the doors off of this thing. Of course, you're going to pay for it, but that's why people have these things, because they can pay for them, because they will pay for themselves very quickly for this type of stuff that they need to do.
But it is important to remember a couple of things. One of them is that for the kinds of work that we all do and that our listeners are presumably interested in us talking about, the tools aren't there yet and show no signs of getting there yet anytime soon for effectively using all of these cores. And while certainly competing vendors could, you know, put out a multi-processor, multi-16-way processor box, as you got to earlier, the power supply is going to be enormous. The thermal considerations are going to be very different.
Right, but this can be just a normal box, though, can contain all that.
I'm not so sure.
Oh, easily.
I mean, like, if the cheese grater had been iterated, they easily could have put two of those things in there.
Yeah, remember the G5s, you know, when they came out, they were water-cooled. They produced a crazy amount of heat.
Did you say water-cooled or poorly water-cooled?
Oh, well, they used, you know, the water cooling they used was actually an AC Delco part.
Yeah.
How crazy is that?
I think it was Delphi Automotive, but yeah, and it wasn't water, it was antifreeze.
Right. And you couldn't get a replacement, and you couldn't get it refilled.
And they leaked. But anyway,
good times.
Yeah, I'd come into work after a hot day, and you know, every couple of months there'd be a puddle under one of the G5s. and I'm actually not kidding. I wish I was.
Your G5 has had a little accident.
It was, you know, we put litter boxes under them, really.
Wee pads, little house break pads, you know.
But where I was going with this, though, is that again, we're into the definition of pro thing. This was something that Maggie said, somebody wake up Hicks, is a question of redefining what pro means. And I think that's a good point. I think that with the kind of processing power available in this machine, at a price point we don't know yet, but we can get to some of those questions shortly, it's how small is the pro market for whom this is not adequate? And I think that's where this gets interesting.
Right. It's a segment of the pro market now.
And I think it's a dwindling segment, again, for something that Maggie touched on in the last episode that we did about this, which is the notion of the software spiral. When this thing will do what it can do with multiple 4K streams, who are the tiny fraction of people that for whom this will not be adequate? And then somebody leaked something, and again, you know, we don't know how true it is, but somebody leaked implications that there is IP over Thunderbolt. And when there's IP over Thunderbolt, you just farm 10 of these things in the corner, and you know, maybe that's better than one multi-core monster.
Well, I will say that A, for listeners, it has been crazy that I thought I was going to be the one defending the machine. And it turns out it's John. But
hey, but, I got a whole bunch of others to defend it.
Yeah,
with
but we joking aside, yeah, we both have our gripes and we both have our likes. Because I also think that for their definition of pro, this is a brilliant machine. My friend Mitch, he's a programmer. He's like, I need RAM, and I need CPUs. I need cores and RAM. I need cores and RAM. And GPUs on top help, you know, and stuff like that. And I was like, well, this isn't the machine for Mitch. But lo and behold, he's like terribly excited by this machine.
Wow.
Yeah. If you are a new editor or someone who has gone wholeheartedly, you know, to Final Cut 10, if you're a DaVinci user, you're a colorist, if you're someone who does pre-production work and you do a lot of showing of, like, you know, high-res video or you're doing presentation of 4K post-production and things like that, this machine is absolutely brilliant for those people, and it's beautiful and it's nice and it'll look lovely in your room, in, you know, whatever setting you put it in. So for that market, which is clearly where Apple is marketing this, it's a great machine. Then the other rest of us kind of fall off the edges. It's not the machine for me, although I say I probably will end up with one day at work. But at home...
Funny how those things just magically find themselves on your desk.
I'm just saying, at work I can, you know, I can see a use case for it. At home, not so much. Then again, I guess my work case, I don't know, my workflow is work changing too, but... So I think it is a brilliant machine for that segment of the market that it is clearly targeted at.
Yeah, I think, you know, we were talking about, you know, the high end versus the really high end versus the not high end, and how that has fluctuated over time, that as CPUs have increased, as I/O has increased, as all that has increased, the people who require the high end devices, the trucks, right, the people who require those are fewer and fewer. And right. I think with the new Mac Pro, you know, its limitations aside, I think that it takes away even more people from the super, super, super high end. You know,
it's a sport utility vehicle in that analogy.
Right. It's a sport utility vehicle based on a car platform versus based on a truck platform. But it will still haul around, you know, seven adults, as it were. You know, if we're gonna completely, right, you know, fuck up this metaphor,
I think you're giving it too little credit, actually.
Well, but I mean, I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean, yeah. I think people that, you know, moved, for instance, to SUVs, it's like you don't actually need a truck. What you need is something that has more volume.
The Mercedes M-Class is a lovely vehicle.
You know? We did the car metaphor last time.
Yeah.
and I'm sure we ruined it.
but all kidding aside, I don't think this is an SUV. I think this is a semi versus a convoy of tandem semis. And again, I'm beating the car or truck, as the case may be, metaphor to death here a bit too. But a couple of things to think about here. We should talk about OpenCL versus CUDA, because sure, I think that Apple has taken a bow shot against CUDA with this release. And I think there's some very significant political reasons.
Right. And they've always drugged their heels about it anyway.
And I think that it matters. And we should go there. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important not to forget that this thing has three Thunderbolt 2.0 buses, or at least we think it does based on, in, you know, reading the tea leaves of Phil Schiller's uncharacteristic.
Right. He did say three controllers. He said FireWire, but he meant Thunderbolt. Yeah. So in theory, there are three Thunderbolt 2 controllers.
Right.
There has to be for that many ports.
Just to confirm my suspicions about this, I actually pinged Red today, and a Red Rocket will work in a PCIe expansion chassis now with four lanes.
Well, I was going to say, that Red Rocket card is only a four-lane card anyway.
From what told me today, it has the potential to be an eight-lane card.
They lied.
they may or may not have lied, but or maybe, you know, we will see one in the future. But a bus of Thunderbolt 2 is eight lanes of PCIe wide.
Well, it's eight lanes. It's eight lanes of PCIe 2 wide.
Exactly.
As opposed to 16 lanes of PCIe 3.
Yes.
Which we now have. in the new Mac Pro. We can't access it because there are no PCI slots, but the bus is PCI 3.
But let's step back to the point of that card, though. I mean, that's probably fine.
Right.
For the actual amount of throughput that the card needs, that the card can actually work on. But, you know, graphics cards, it's a whole different game. Of course, you're not going to be putting outboard graphics cards on this thing because it has these two giant GPUs inside of it. So, but for some outboard data cards that do processing, as long as they don't need the constant feed of more data than say, 8 lanes of PCIe 2, then that's probably okay.
Right. I mean, I know a lot of folk who are using external enclosures for GPU compute stuff.
Right, you can do it. You're just not going to get the full bandwidth.
You're hobbling yourself to some extent. But that said, GPU compute is very, very different than real-time visualization. Real-time visualization requires that very, very, very fast bus. If you're basically just like cramming a giant cache, which is your GPU's RAM, you know, with data, having it crunch those numbers a whole bunch and then send back data, that can be done in Thunderbolt, you know, with a much lower bandwidth because it doesn't matter. You know, you're not trying to do this stuff in real time. Whereas, if you're trying to do very complex real-time visualization, that's a different story. That's when you do need the larger bus.
So if we consider the pro market, and we're going to set aside the hundreds and hundreds of people, maybe thousands or tens of thousands who are going to buy this just because it's cool, my perception of this is that despite, quote, redefining pro, which is where Maggie was going before and I think even now, the percentage of this pro market that this device serves, especially with three controllers worth of Thunderbolt 2, is a pretty broad swath.
It's pretty huge. But here's where I think it falls down. Right now, with this thing that is not out yet, right, it has...
That we don't know the price of, that which we'll get to
right,
a bit.
That we also don't know the price of, right? And it's not out yet. But we do have an understanding of what its capabilities are, right? Because we think we know the GPUs, or at least we've got a ballpark figure of the GPUs. We definitely know the CPUs, and we also know the maximum amount of RAM that it can take, at least with 4 DIMMs. So what we can say, though, is that today this thing screams. But what happens next year when NVIDIA comes out with the new hotness? What happens next year when ATI comes out with the new hotness? And your dual GPUs, you know, looked great today, but they don't look so hot tomorrow.
And I would throw the following thoughts out on that one. I'm still running 2010 or 11 vintage, I have to look, but it doesn't really matter, vintage Mac Pros. And the fact is that they're faster for this kind of heavy lifting than the fastest iMac you can buy today. And they're more than just faster, they're better suited to cooking overnight than I would feel comfortable day in and day out doing to an iMac. And these are 3-year-old machines. What is the depreciation life of a desktop PC realistically? 3 years. I would submit that by the time these things come out, they'll be the first batch of that series of Intel chip. They'll be out for 9 months or so, or however long, and they will absolutely go through their depreciation life. And yes, we can't go out and spend another $1,200 on the new hotness for video cards, but again, we don't know the price of the device. If this is a $10,000 beautiful black tube, we have a problem. If it's a $3,000 beautiful black tube, that's a whole different question. And I think there are some reasons to think this may be more inexpensive than we might expect.
I don't see that, but...
Do go on.
I can say that, you know, one of the things that one of the reasons why I buy the Mac Pro towers is that I keep these things for 5-6 years, right? I kept my G5 for 5 years. And the reason why I was able to keep it was I was able to upgrade the video card for $200. And, you know, I don't need the Quadro cards because, quite frankly, the the gaming cards on the Mac are, you know, they're not necessarily to the same standards, but they are.
But they will spank the crap out of a Quadro.
They are just as fast, if not way faster, than a Quadro, and they are fully supported on the Mac. They're not fully supported on Windows, and that's a big distinction. And so that's one of the weirdnesses of the Mac versus the PC, because the Quadro cards exist, but because there are so many non-Quadro cards available in the laptop line, and so many cards that are available even without reflashing the ROMs on them, you still have the ability to run CUDA applications on these. And so if you talk to NVIDIA, they will support you, whereas they will not do that on Windows. So, for a couple $100, if I can breathe new life into a machine that has become pokey, that's worthwhile to me. And now I feel I don't. And again, a lot of this comes down to the price, right? If it's $2,000, like, good luck with that, right? But let's say for sake of argument, it's $2,000. Well, all right, $2,000, I can deal with being, yeah, totally. But if it's $2,000, all right, I can live with being pokey for an extra year, because my day job doesn't require that I have the fastest. My profit doesn't come out of my ability to render things really, really fucking fast, right? But if that was my job, to render things as fast as humanly possible, it would be a no-go for me. It would be a non-starter for me.
Well, let's all go home.
if you were a raging lunatic and went out and paid full boat retail for a Mac Pro right now, 2 6-core Xeons, 2.4 gigahertz, 16 gigs of RAM, 1 7200 RPM drive, and 2 5770 graphics cards is $4,200.
Right, and that's crazy town in its own right.
No question. That's crazy town in its own right. But the new Mac, how heavy is it? And that really matters. That absolutely affects the cost of making these machines, is shipping them around. And 40-some pounds of Mac Pro is a non-trivial thing to ship around.
Ah, but you don't have to ship it from China this time.
Well, no, but you might have to ship it back to China, but that's another story.
And that's one of the nice aspects of it as well, is that, this is, I guess, was it official? This is definitely made in the US?
Yeah, it's the return to the made in USA.
And it's also actually assembled in the USA. I mean, it's not actually made.
And that's easy, because this is a specialty machine. You're not making a gazillion of them. So we talked about that before, saying that, that if they're going to pick a machine to do that with, this is probably the one to do it with.
We totally picked that. Our prediction quality on that was dead on right.
we got
something.
We got
one. Right. Woohoo!
No, we got a few other things right too, but we got that one very definitely right. So you're not dealing with the physical mass. You're not dealing with the physical volume. I think it's a reasonable certainty that a single fan Darth Mac versus I think 6 or 7, I'd have to count them, fans with my GPUs and motherboard fans and my cheese grater, that's a significant drop in the bomb, one fan versus six. No optical drives, no spinning disks, no fiddly weird little trays for the drives. And while each one of those things is pennies apiece, that's an assembly process, that's a complexity. This new Mac is a much lighter, smaller, lower materials count, simpler thing to build.
Well, it's completely modular too. If you look at the way that it's going to be put together, setting aside the fact that I didn't realize that the power supply was in there, but if you look at the, the site where it shows you it opening it up and it rotates around, it's clear that it's going to be very simple for them to assemble. I mean, you could actually probably do this mostly by hand and it would still be cost effective, because like that flash storage is, it just clips into a connector and whatnot.
All of those things will impact the final price of this machine.
But I still think $3,200 on the low end. But I think there will probably be more than one version.
We're going to see a different number of cores and gigahertz ranges. I think we're also going to see You know, the website says two GPUs, full stop. But during the presentation, I believe Shilla said up to two GPUs. So it's entirely possible that there's going to be a single GPU, maybe, you know, 2 gigabytes or 3 gigabytes of RAM with a hexa-core, fairly low gigahertz speed.
Let me read something to you. When we were talking about how much RAM the cards have, so here's how it reads on the site. Not only does it feature a state-of-the-art AMD FirePro workstation class GPU. Well, no, then it goes on to say it features two of them.
Right.
So, it does imply.
There is ambiguity.
Yeah, and it is 6 gigabytes per, up to 6 gigabytes per card.
Right, so, which is crazy.
But I agree with you. I think there's a very real possibility of a single GPU, 6-core, you know, low-end version of this. But it's Apple. You don't know. They love cachet. Maybe here is the machine you get, and this is
Even the low end. I mean, for example, the low end Mac Pro currently is selling for like $3,200, They really.
But that's a nothing machine. That machine does not compete with anything on the market. You're getting that because you want a Mac Pro,
right? And when I got my Mac Pro, which is right when they announced the hexa-core versions, they had the quote low end, which is actually the mid range of last seasons of last year's, like 5 years ago now. And that's where I was getting at with the low end. You know, they'll probably still sell, you know, the low end, which is just it's there, it's a price point, you know, but it's not a good value. I think that's a possibility. It's interesting to me because it says up to 6 gigabytes of RAM. I don't see how they would be able to, because if I recall correctly, all that RAM is soldered onto those boards. So they would have to have a bunch of them, you know, swapped in and out, and that just seems weird to me.
Yeah, that leads me to believe that there are at least two versions of the card that you can get.
Right.
Like, you can buy this one with 3 gigabyte per card, or this one with 6 gigabytes per
card. Also says to me that they are not aftermarket, you know, swappable. You know, much like
everything else. They're not. Yeah. If you look at them, they're totally custom-made.
Oh, well, the boards are certainly custom. You know, these are not PCIe cards by any stretch of the imagination. But I was hoping that maybe as an aftermarket or something like that, they would just, you know, sell them. But it's pretty clear that they don't intend to do that, simply because, you know, there would be no market for it. Why would you buy the thing and then have to pay another, let's say for sake of argument, $700 for a swap?
So hold on. Let me go throw a couple of thoughts out for you guys. First of all, I think it's highly unlikely that the GPUs will be user swappable, because in order for that to be the case, end users would need to peel off heatsink compound, clean it, and replace it. And that's just not someplace that Apple's going to go.
True.
Totally. Yeah, right.
And while they could be a genius installable upgrade, they're not going to be an end user installable upgrade. That's the first thing to throw out. The other thing to bear in mind here is that, and I am no wizard at the grand matrix strategy, but the price points, if you go from top end Mac Mini, if you skip the server version, at $800, to top end iMac at $2,000, to entry to Mac Pro at $2,500, this does not point to a $4,000 Darth Mac. It just doesn't.
But it doesn't point to a $2,000 Darth Mac either, because you've got a $2,000 iMac.
It doesn't point to a $2,000 Darth Mac, but I absolutely think that it could point to a $2,500 Darth Mac.
Ooh, interesting.
But I mean, they're charging you $2,500 now for a quad core.
Well, not only that, but part of the reason why the current Mac Pros are priced what they are, because they used to be more expensive, right? The part of the reason why they're priced what they are is that they're 3 years out of date.
Yeah, they're old.
So I don't know if comparing today's prices of today's Mac Pro to tomorrow's new tube makes sense.
But let's not forget, this is Apple too. They're not going to price it based on what they make, what it costs them to make it.
Right. Sure.
They're going to price it based on what they want to sell it for.
Right, they're Louis Vuitton.
And if they think right now that they can sell you a $3,800, if they have the flagship Mac Pro now is, you know, it's 12 cores, it's $3,800. If that's what they think that they can sell the flagship now, then there's very likely to be, you know, at least that for the new flagship.
I don't unfortunately have the records for this. I wish I did. But my recollection of this is that a sane person would buy it config of a Mac Pro has always hovered between 25 and 29 as the sort of minimum reasonable entry point back when the machines were current.
For anyone who's not being buying a built to order, yes.
Right. But the thing is that you're right, though. They used to be $24.99 or whatever, and they started getting up to $3,000 minimum.
I remember one that was close to $4,000.
Yeah, and you know, and those were the ones that were also fairly useless. You know, by the time you got finished outfitting it, you were down for $3,600 to $4,200.
Exactly, and I don't see a scenario where we enter into the world of the new Mac Pro, aka Darth Mac, in this weird rarefied air that we're in right now. And I think some of that has to do with the positioning of the Intel parts that they're using in the current machines and their relative rarity in the consumer market.
Well, that's another problem.
I think their price is preserved in a way that the entry-level next-generation Intel chips may not be.
Well, that's another problem, too. This part's new, and it's going to be necessarily expensive because it's new.
Well, and Intel charges whatever the f*** they want to charge because they've got no competition.
When a new family and class comes out, it's always expensive to start with. It's just the way they do it. It's always expensive to start with.
And what other single vendor than Apple in this current climate will sell as many of these chips?
They're not going to sell a crap load of these Mac Pros.
HP and Dell and IBM alone will sell rings around the amount of versus the Mac Pro. I mean, that's Apple no longer has the cachet. Well, actually, technically, Apple never really, really had the cachet.
They negotiated very well, though.
You're forgetting something. Dell, IBM, and HP are going to be selling these Xeons into the corporate market.
Sure.
And
right, but they're
going to
be selling crap tons of them. I mean, because these places, you know, you go in and you buy 200 Z820s, you know, you don't buy, you know, one or two. And these Mac Pros are going to be selling to a very select market of professionals who do a certain thing or who are Mac people.
And also, in general, Apple's going to be selling directly, and they're selling directly to a person. You know, yeah, there are some institutions there, but the thing is, they don't even have the infrastructure for that either.
Yeah, yes, they will get a better price, a good price, but this part is a brand new family, so Intel is going to charge a lot to start with because they're going to start recouping their R&D on this thing immediately. Yeah.
And Apple may even get lucky and say, you know, get some exclusivity on this particular part as well, which they've done in the past. You know, it's like, oh, you have 4 months of exclusivity. Big deal, you know?
Right, but even with that, you're looking at, we were talking about how it compares across the, you know, good, better, best. You're getting a machine, the one with all the stuff. You're getting a machine that has all the stuff that you had to kind of add on BTO to get the previous Mac Pro up to spec. You know, you're getting two graphic cards. You're getting a lot of RAM. You're getting, well, presumably somewhat large amount of flash storage. I still not sure how much that's going to be, but that's also going to be expensive because that particular type of flash RAM and that form factor is very expensive.
Right, and Apple's always charged a gigantic premium for that.
Right, and you're getting a brand new family of CPU, which Apple is clearly getting early parts for.
Apple will be selling those Macs not just to the pros, but to all of the wannabe pros. Apple will be selling these Macs to everybody who wind us into this problem in the first place and asked for a mid-tower.
I don't think so. I really don't think so. I think a lot of people will be buying them, or at least a giant chunk of them are. But I don't think that we're going to see a mass market, and by mass I mean the whiners who want the new Mac Pro. I don't think so. I think that, you know, I was listening to the Syracuse and Armand's new podcast, the Accidental Tech Podcast. And, you know, they were both saying that, like, yeah, this isn't really the machine I'm looking for, because Syracuse was saying that, you know, it has these professional level cards and he's a gamer and he wants a gaming card. And this is the first time that he's possibly not going to get one. And Marco was in a similar camp. I think what will wind up happening is they'll probably wind up both getting them. But the people who would normally buy them because they were gamers or because they felt like having the big, shiny behemoth rather than like the happy, you know, iMac, I think there are going to be fewer of those.
Well, I'm not talking millions of customers. I'm talking tens of thousands.
Right, but what I'm saying, though, is that while tens of thousands of customers will be buying the new Mac Pro, millions of seats will be purchased from HP and Dell and IBM.
I don't believe for a second that HP, Dell, and IBM are selling millions of units into server rooms for corporate corporations. I just don't think that the corporate market is, and I think that the corporate market is slow to move. It won't be that they won't be first movers on the new part from Intel. Anyway, we're in the land of pure speculation here.
but the difference being that this particular part, this family of parts, will be used on workstations as well as servers. So that's a lot of chips to sell.
Yeah.
How many people are buying workstations anymore?
Hey, man.
Your entire institution, I think, Maggie.
Yeah. I mean, Christopher and I have been talking a lot about the HP Z series. I mean, those things sell very well in that they are sometimes hard to get. So.
Again, I think we're talking very well in the desktop computer range of very well versus very well in the, you know, looks just like a MacBook Pro, but isn't, or a MacBook Air, but isn't very well. I think we're talking very well into the verticals that we're talking about is not
right,
the same.
Right, but all of that is still far and above, way and above the numbers that Apple will be selling. There, no matter how you look at it, they're still vastly larger numbers.
In aggregate, we agree. Yeah. From any single vendor, I'm less convinced.
Right, but the point, though, is ultimately about this is that Apple is not shaping the part, whereas in the past, when they had their partnership with IBM, they were able to shape the PPC. Apple is not able to shape the part from Intel.
They will be paying for this part. They will get a good price, but it will not be cheap.
They'll get a good price, and they may get exclusivity, but it's not. Yeah,
well,
it's not going to be.
I don't think that's going to happen.
Well, maybe not. I mean, the point is that, you know, yes, they're going to be paying a lot for the part, and Apple
And this is currently the high end of that part family. It won't ultimately be, but at this point on the roadmap, that is the high-end CPU in that family.
Right, and Apple being Apple, right, they certainly do like to charge what they feel like charging versus, you know, making 2% margin. So it's definitely going to be vastly more expensive than the sum of its parts, and that's fine. I guess the question really becomes, you know, do you trust a Rev A of something so radically different with radically new parts? I particularly don't. I'd like to see this out in the field for a few months, start, you know, getting some feedback, really seeing what works, what doesn't, before I commit. I'm not going to go out day one. I'm also not needing to because I've got a shiny hexacore that is suiting me just fine. Yeah. But one of the things that I really wanted to get to was, you know, we talked about pro versus non-pro. I actually made a list of things that I deemed pro versus not pro. That is the Xeon chip. We decided, you know, that makes it pro. It's got one. We're good there. Right. It's got ECC RAM. That also makes it pro. Definitely got that there. Really good. Very happy about that. PCIe-based SSDs, those are super pro. I mean, that's, you know, if you're directly on the PCIe bus, you're going to look at 700 plus megabytes per second. That's pretty pro.
If you've never used the Excelsior product from Otherworld Computing, if you think your SSD is fast, you're kidding yourself.
Yeah.
You're putting a controller and a memory bus and all this ahead of it. Yeah, when you slap that sucker down into the PCIe bus, oh my God.
It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, and in the current Mac Pros, it's a 3 gigabits per second SATA interface.
It's not even SATA 3. It's SATA 2, which is ridiculous.
It's Maxellad, to date ourselves again. The hair blown back on the chair listening to the loud music. The speed of the internal storage on this machine is going to be ridiculous compared to anything that you've ever dealt with before, unless you've gone to OWC and bought one of those cards. Right. Now,
in which case, that's now normal for you, and that's your baseline. You probably won't see much change.
except for that machine will be faster too. It has faster RAM, faster CPU.
Well, that's the whole thing too. Yeah. A lot of the tests and stuff like that we've been seeing, you know, a lot of those are memory I/O bound, and the new Mac Pro has a greatly expanded I/O channel, and so we're seeing stuff.
Or one might just say modern.
We're now in what should have been today, right? You know, as opposed to 3 years ago.
The Mac Pro that we didn't get should have had this,
right?
Well, or close to it. It should have been 1600.
But the Mac Pro we didn't get couldn't exist because there were no Xeon class processors for which you could have Thunderbolt.
Yeah.
We can't blame Apple for that.
And I'm still very curious as to how that works, because from what I gather, that's actually still technically the case, but they've done something really wacky with it. I've heard rumors, and again, this is rumor and speculation. This is not, you know, something that I definitely know from the engineers and da 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 da. I've heard from folk that one of the GPUs is actually meant for the displays, and the other GPU is meant for compute. And I'm wondering how that's going to work with potentially lots of 4K displays, but it's entirely possible that the problem of having multiple graphics cards in with a Thunderbolt interface hasn't really been solved necessarily, but they had a clever workaround. We'll obviously see when it actually finally comes out and things get taken apart and da-da-da-da. But I found that quite interesting, that both GPUs are not necessarily equal in that regard, in their role. They may be physically identical, but they're different in their role.
Yeah,
and that probably has to do with the way mini display port is handled in the machine. I don't know. We're in deep hardware voodoo.
Right.
Yeah, right, exactly.
What is related to that, what's interesting is if you look at the photographs of what is a pre-production machine, they're geographically and mechanically, it would appear that there should be room, and there's even silkscreened indication that there is a place to solder on another one of the little sockets for the memory stick thing.
For the storage, yeah, for the mass storage, yeah.
But that it's not present in those photographs. And one question is, will there be another slot for a second stick in these machines at release? Right.
More likely that would come on Rev B, I would guess, anyway. Mm. But I can totally see it happening.
Or not. Maybe there's some architectural reason it's not there, but they made one board layout preliminarily. I just don't know the answer. But
or it's just that it's the same card, duplicated, and that's just, you know, it's cheaper to make it that way.
Yeah, or it could be one of those things where it's like, okay, well, you know, you can get, you can get 512 gigabytes of storage, and that's actually going to be two sticks of 256 gigabytes. Very much like the motherboards that had the single CPU in them, they had traces for the second CPU, but it didn't come with it. Like they were silkscreen, but they weren't actually drawn.
Yep. And we don't know the answer to this. One interesting tidbit is, let's say that there is a one of the concerns that I have about this machine is that because it appears from the photographs we've seen that there's only one slot for this flash storage module, I don't like using the word memory sticks, so I'm changing it to flash storage.
Storage module,
memory
sure.
sticky thingy.
Well, memory stick versus RAM, right? So, yeah, no, storage module is perfectly cromulent.
So we'll go with the cromulence of the storage module, and we'll embiggen the discussion by saying that I personally would rather have two of those in, say, you know, 640 gig modules that I could RAID one, given the relative brittleness and catastrophic nature of a flash failure, than a single larger module. And that one of the things I feel like we've given up from the older cheese grater chassis is the idea that you can have an internal degree of redundancy that single module port, if you will, or slot, but I don't like that word either, as we see in the photographs, deprives us of.
Right. And that's and that's definitely one of the non-pro things I had listed, right? So that I was also seeing the no PCIe slots. You know, while I think Thunderbolt can take care of a lot of our needs, there's a lot of stuff, again, like, high-end GPUs. Those cards are not swappable. You know, they're great today and not tomorrow.
The irony is this machine illustrates the blazing speed you can get by popping things straight onto the PCIe bus while simultaneously not giving you any of them to mess with.
Yeah. And so all your AJA cards, all that stuff, you know, now granted, again, a lot of those have turned Thunderbolt because, you know, everyone's editing in the field on their laptops, which is great, which is absolutely fabulous. But
and they're currently not, you know, pulling in 8K and stuff, so it's okay.
Yeah, today, at the moment. But that's the other thing too. When the non-Apple technology leaps, the thing that you have invested is now no longer viable because you cannot upgrade to use the new like, for example, let's say, for sake of argument, in 2 years when Sony comes out with their 8K camera, or even Red when they finally start shipping the Dragon, which, okay, that's 2030, but still.
And in theory, there's another card that they will come along with.
More lanes. What they're charging for the Rocket is ridiculous considering how old the tech is. And like what we said, the current card is only a 4-lane card. I can certainly see with the new sensors and the new amounts of data and all that to require faster than Thunderbolt can currently give, even Thunderbolt 2. Which is actually really just aggregated, like properly aggregated Thunderbolt 1, by the way. There's no big change in Thunderbolt 2.
Right. I mean, of course, this is still the copper Thunderbolt.
There's no big change in Thunderbolt 2, except that Thunderbolt 1 implementation is 2 4-lane cards that at max in an expansion chassis, and in Thunderbolt 2, it's the potential for 1 8-lane card. That is a non-trivial improvement.
That's significant, sure.
The differences in PCIe 3 and PCIe 2 speeds, and then eight lanes over 16 lanes, you know, like 16 lanes of PCIe 3 is nearly 16 gigabytes per second. But Thunderbolt 2 could conceivably handle 8 lanes of PCIe 2. So that's not a problem. But in the future, who knows? I mean, we're going to get into some scary territory. But then again, you know, you may say, oh, well, here's the new Mac Pro with, you know, with the new optical Thunderbolt that Intel finally got going. It was supposed to be.
But it's interesting to me that Apple went with ATI versus the current reigning champion. And I know we wanted to get to this, NVIDIA with their cards. Now, whether or not that was just a, you know, hey, these guys offered a better heat profile and power profile. But, I mean, let's call it what it is. Everyone who's doing something professional with compute is really doing it via CUDA, you know, because they're faster, you know, NVIDIA's faster at, you know, increasing the compute power in their cards than any other vendor. And, you know, OpenCL is lovely, and by its nature, it can see and deal with multiple cards, which is lovely. But, you know, CUDA cards can also run OpenCL. So why not have, you know, the current and future reigning champ as an option?
I think I know. And John and I have kind of kicked this around a little bit. You know, I mean, one, Apple is, you know, balls to the wall, OpenCL. They don't care about CUDA. They've clearly not cared about CUDA all along. NVIDIA has, of course, and they've been, you know, dragging people along. But OpenCL is their thing. And that's what that's the target that they've got their eye on.
Right.
And I'm sure that the AMD says, hey, we like that because, you know, they can't compete with the CUDA thing right now. But if they can say, along with Apple, go, we will help you make this crap work and we will help you design these cards for your new thing. And, you know, we want to be on board for that. I'm sure it's a partnership thing.
And I think you certainly hit something there. But there's the other half of it, which is NVIDIA just has faster, better chips. Full stop.
Yes, I mean,
CUDA aside.
Right.
So
but now, of course, you know that. So if from Apple's point of view, this thing is a Final Cut Pro machine.
Right.
You know,
and so if you're
going to tune Final Cut Pro for AMD and OpenCL and OpenGL and, you know.
So. Totally. And, you know.
So they don't care about CUDA.
Right. And that's going
to
be great.
It's not that they don't care about CUDA. It's that they don't want to be dependent on CUDA.
Well, and yeah, honestly, there's that too. They want to own the dog food they eat.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, actually, in the case of OpenCL, they want everybody to own the dog food they eat.
Right, but what I mean is that's OpenCL is where when people laid down their money, NVIDIA and Adobe threw their money in, you know, in the CUDA side, and Apple said nope, and threw theirs in OpenCL. That's what I mean. That's where their focus is. So. CUDA is not on their radar.
Well, it makes it so that they're not beholden to a single company, which makes perfect sense for Apple. I mean, look at with Maps and all their other, you know, former partnerships where it's like, hey, we're big enough that we don't want to have to rely on an external vendor for this information or this hardware or whatever, because there may come a time where, you know, our relationship is no longer convenient for you and you ditch us. Well, you know, we're big enough that we don't have to take that shit anymore. And,
I mean,
you know.
Yeah, and in that respect, if you look at these GPUs that they're putting in this machine, it's a complete win for the user that it is designed for.
Oh, completely.
For that user, this is a monster machine.
Yeah, and I think also, you know, we talked about the, you know, the graphics cards are great today, but what about tomorrow? I think merely having two of them is certainly going to extend the shelf life of that. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's got both of them in there.
I really wonder if you guys aren't underestimating the importance of the no CUDA argument. The people behind not CUDA are Intel, Apple, AMD. AMD and Intel are agreeing that OpenCL is a better plan. A universe where AMD and Intel agree on anything is a pretty strange one.
But see, I understand what you're saying, but it's not that we're arguing that there's anything against, we're arguing against that in any way. It's really that for some people, that's a jumping off point. For me, I have become an Adobe user, so right now I need CUDA. So it's a jumping off point for me. I can't throw myself into this other machine.
Well,
a lot of people will be able to.
Actually, on the plus side, there in Adobe CC, the new Creative Cloud stuff,
there's movement.
There is significant OpenCL change. You know, it's much, much faster than CS6. So that's
right, and I fully expect that will become the case, which is good. This is what case where competition will probably work in everyone's benefit. But right now, the hot rod that I'm racing requires
CUDA and lots of it. Well, the other thing too is that OpenCL and CUDA are not the same thing. Meaning that you know, OpenCL is meant to run on every core, like regardless, it's actually core agnostic. So if it finds GPU cores, if it finds CPU cores, OpenCL runs on all of that. So it will find all of the resources it can. You know, that with.
And that's what makes it better.
Right. Overall.
All of the resources it can, whether or not they are made by NVIDIA.
Right. Precisely.
Right.
You know, but really, this is a really big deal.
I want to make sure. I want to make sure that you understand though that I agree with that. Yeah. I'm just saying that where we are now at this moment in time, this new Mac Pro is not for me, and a lot of it's to do with the GPUs. That will change over time,
right? And that gets to a lot of the concerns that you've expressed about the non-upgradability and the future-proof or future-resistant.
Future doesn't get me a machine tomorrow, though. That's the thing.
There's no question. It is important to remember that this machine's not due out until the fall. So in 3 or 4 months, stuff will – or 2 to 4 months, stuff's
going to happen. And I've already bought parts to not to replace.
Well, and also the other thing is that, you know, the other day – NVIDIA came out with new CUDA drivers that operate CC like twice as fast as it did the other day, literally. It's in certain cases. And you know, that's it's just because that the NVIDIA GPUs, obviously, and CUDA is owned by NVIDIA totally. So they can tune a lot better than the OpenCL consortium can deal with what they need to do as well. So that's just going to be the nature of the beast. That if you have something, if you have someone that owns the full stack with regard to compute, they're going to be able to move faster than a giant consortium that has a by definition more abstract layer.
Which and is the same thing, or sort of thing we've praised Apple for when they've, you know, done the same sort of thing with, you know, apps or this or that.
Totally,
you
know? Totally.
But the more. Granted, theoretically, CUDA is an abstraction, but the more it is the case that NVIDIA can do what they need to with CUDA to make CUDA perform, the more vendors are going to be in the land of needing to play catch-up with whatever NVIDIA may unilaterally decide they want to do with CUDA.
For the Adobe people of the world... We're just winning off of this. I mean, yes, it will change, and yes, things could go south. But right now, the Adobe people of the world are winning because of NVIDIA. Right. We're winning in within our world.
Well, and the 3D people, and the massive scientific compute people as well. It's just the nature of the beast. I mean, it comes down to, regardless of CUDA, it comes down to NVIDIA has the better cards, full stop. And AMD is kind of distant, and they seem to get kind of lapped every time the new generation of cards come out.
They are playing catch up.
And that's a problem. Now, granted, OpenCL will get better, and that's lovely, and competition is really good. But if you need to be on the fastest thing, the reality of the situation is, for the foreseeable future, you're going with NVIDIA.
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, again, the GPUs in this new Mac Pro are fast. They're, you know, they're hella fast.
We don't really know what they are. All we know is they're branded Fire Pro.
Right.
Right. Well, I mean, if they are, you know, some level of equality with their slot in peers, you know, then they're clearly very fast. Presumably, they're just built on that, I would assume, which is good because those cards are very, very fast. They're just not the fastest.
Right. But they have better power profiles.
Yeah, they do have a really, really good power profile.
Right. And when you're doing massively parallel stuff, when you've got, you know, several thousand of them in enclosures in a giant room somewhere, you know, your power profile matters. Your heat profile matters. So on that level, you know, that's really lovely. And in something that's enclosed in a tiny little ash can like this, that matters as well.
What will the environment for professional applications a year from now be if, in fact, OpenCL, as many very muscular individuals want it to be, displaces CUDA as a place where even Adobe wants to make their major investments?
Oh, I think we'll see Adobe moving to invest more and more in OpenCL. I mean, I do think that's going to happen. I mean, I believe that they will maintain CUDA as well, but I think we'll see some sidereal adoption of it. So then
when we're using more GPUs for general compute, and we have 8-lane Thunderbolt 2, and you can put NVIDIA cards in 8-lane Thunderbolt 2 enclosures, hypothetically, and farm up a bunch of these things, or we get IP over Thunderbolt and you can farm up a bunch of Macs, this whole landscape just starts getting weird.
Right. It actually becomes more fragile in that case. You know, and that was one of the things that sort of stunned me, was that, like, well, you know, now everything is external, which means that now we've got more cords everywhere. And you know those, you know, the Thunderbolt cords are not locking cords. So, and you keep on plugging them and plugging them back in, they get brittle. You know, eventually they'll die. Not to mention they're like $50 a pop.
They get mechanically fragile, sure. But conversely, you know, you don't, how many of those little plastic tabs on Mac Pros have you broken off before they had the metal rail? The card retaining tabs? I'm just citing a silly example.
Sure, sure.
You know, we're not swapping out our graphics cards every 4 months.
Right. But we are swapping hard drives all the time.
God, I love that metal tab. Sorry.
The metal bar? Oh, the metal bar makes me smile every time.
My G5 had a metal bar, and my Mac Pro has a metal bar. So somewhere in the middle, they were plastic at one point.
Oh, you skipped the Instabrake locking tabs that were made of plastic.
Oh,
yes.
Gods.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's unfortunate.
Bad juju. Once it's Thunderbolt, and once it's, I mean, 20 gigabits per second per bus is a bit ridiculous in terms of bandwidth.
But it's not when you start ganging everything together.
I don't know. I don't think we'll see a lot of that, at least not in this initial machine, because it's going to do what it does, and it's going to do that well. I don't think you're going to see people trying to shove a bunch of NVIDIA cards off the side of it, because they're going to look at that and they're going to go with a different model if that's really what they need to do.
Right, because they'll get better value out of something that has six available slots. Right.
I mean, and to be honest, I joked about it earlier, but I really did. I had to sit down the other day, and I think I was tweeting with you about this. It's like, do I buy the crazy expensive final cheese grater because I have a specific use case need, and I, you know, or do I not? And I went with not. I've bought a bunch of parts and I've built a machine to fill that slot, and I'm gonna end up hackintoshing it. That's not, you know, that's just because of this particular use case. It could have been a Linux box or whatever, but
right. And it's also your personal thing, right?
Well, this is
for work. Was it for work? Oh, okay. But then again, you are the IT department for your stuff. So,
you know, right. I mean, I'm going to support myself, so right. It's not a problem there.
Yeah, a normal institution can't do that.
So I have this machine, and I'm like, I need to replace that machine with, it's a Mac Pro. I need to replace that machine with something. Mm-hmm. And the new Mac Pro is not going to do what I need this thing to do just because of legacy stuff. So yeah, I mean, you know, there's that kind of use case where I'm not going to like look at the new Mac Pro and go, how can I stick this thing off of, you know, hang this off a Thunderbolt, because it's not the right use case for me.
Right.
I don't really think we'll be seeing a lot of that. I mean, because, you know, even like you say, AJA, even Avid has a Thunderbolt adapter now, you know?
Yeah.
So people are good. They're going to work around it. And then we'll see a new bus, not immediately. And who knows at what version of what machine we'll see it. But, you know, Thunderbolt 2 will be old one day, you know?
Sure.
So there'll be something else.
Sure. When NBC Sports rolls a bunch of hardware to go do the Olympics, those boxes are not Hackintoshes. Those boxes might be Windows boxes. They're probably not Linux boxes.
Right, right. No, I'm just talking about from my particular use case. Because I would say I can't do the whole Thunderbolt hanging off. That was my point. Not that. Yeah, I mean, if I'm NBC Sports, I'm going to carry what's roadworthy.
Right. Well, the other thing too is it probably wouldn't be
roadworthy. What's modular? What's swappable? What, you know? So let's say
that Mac Pro is probably not a good choice for that, though.
At all. Especially considering that, I mean, if you take a look at it, you know, you take a look at Dell, you take a look at HP. When you buy a workstation machine from Dell or HP, it comes with a Ninja Strike Force that will meet you wherever the fuck you are and replace your shit within 24 hours, where you don't get that at Apple, full stop.
Right, and you're going to have a box that, like, it's going to be more like John was talking about earlier. It's probably going to have to run Windows, but, you know, it's going to be a box with all the stuff that it needs already in it, that had swappable parts. You know, maybe it's even racked.
And I can I can see, you know, a bunch of Mac laptops, but I can I also see the heavy lifting done by, you know, a Z800 series or a Z820 series,
or even Mac Pros. I mean, the
old ones. Oh, sure.
Because, you know, yes, they are old hardware and stuff, but to a degree, they're still quite usable. Yeah.
An AJA Key Pro deck is $4,000. You know, for the kinds of things that people are going to be deploying these boxes to cut in the field, to do production work in the field, whether it's, you know, my pipe dream entry level machine in the $2,500 to $2,800 range, if my dream comes true, or in a worst case scenario, a $3,500 to $4,500 range, as the suite of gadgets that you buy to do high volume, large scale production, the box itself is cheap.
Sure.
In whether it's at either end of those two extremes, extreme optimism or extreme pessimism, it's the cheapest piece of all your toys.
I think also, though, I mean, especially with if you're doing live events and such, you know, chances are fairly good you really can get away with a laptop even. So, I mean, does it even really matter anymore?
Well, it depends on what we're talking about here, too. I mean, because I'm sitting here, I'm trying to imagine this as John talks, you know. I've got the Dyson tube.
And yes.
You know.
That was very good. You know, find new ways to make fun of them every show.
Next year, it's going to have a ball.
And let's say I need four machines, and you know, and then I set these up, and they've got monitors for them, and then I start plugging this outboard PCIe chassis for my Teradek cards and my Asias and all this stuff. Or I don't know. I mean, if just the frugal part of me says, well, I could probably rack three machines and do all of that other stuff, and then carry one of these machines for the nice display and playback and stuff. You know, and everything else on laptops. I don't know. I think it has a place, but it really depends on your use case to me. The outboard stuff is where I start to have that real problem.
Right. I think we can rationalize a use case for pretty much anything where the new Mac Pros would work really well, and we can equally rationalize a place where they wouldn't work well. So I don't know. I mean,
sure.
I think it comes down to, you know what? They're going to be the right thing for a lot of people. I think that, again, it's all dependent on price point, but I think that the new machine, even with all of its limitations, serves way more professionals than it alienates. And I think that's, I think that's a win.
Yeah. It makes new professionals too.
If you're outfitting a production studio, how much more often do you replace your half a dozen Key Pros than you do your cutting station?
Right. Oh, but in a sit down production facility, that's totally different. I mean, we were talking about field work. Sit down production, it's no big deal because you plug stuff in and stays plugged in. You know, so that's fine.
In your truck, let's say you're rolling a production truck where the stuff is mounted in cabinetry in the production truck.
Except, how do you mount a Promise RAID in a cab? You have to build it instead of using a rack, though.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've been on those buses. The racks are there, but the racks are furniture with, you know, ear bars.
This is a debate that can go on forever because we can rationalize anything.
This is the first time that we've had a conversation like this where we don't essentially completely agree.
Right.
Usually when we chat, we're all pretty much on the same page and we're sort of iterating with each other to get to what we think the right answer is. In this case, I think we not only do we not necessarily agree with each other, but I'm not sure we agree with ourselves.
Sure.
Right? I'm not convinced one way or the other on this box. I'm looking at a lot of upsides. I'm looking at a world where we have IO that's wholly different from anything we ever used to have. I'm looking at a world where essentially, as jarring to the industry as FireWire was when FireWire came out, Thunderbolt has the potential to be equally jarring again. And I'm saying, you know, this could be a major game changer in the way people work. If 2 weeks before FireWire shipped, or 2 months before the first FireWire iMac shipped, we predicted how that would fundamentally alter the way video got made, we'd be rich.
But let me jump in and say too that another thing, I mean, I agree. I totally agree with all that. I think this is just the start of that, though, because, for instance, I talked about this other machine and I thought about whether this new Mac Pro is not for me. However, I have fully bought into Thunderbolt, and the new machine I've built has 2 Thunderbolt ports on it. So, you know, I'm totally in that camp. I'm all up ons.
So, nice. Well, that's the other thing too. It's like, you know, you're daisy chaining, but at the same time, there are rules to the daisy chaining. You know, it's like going back to the SCSI days where, you know, you can only have X number of devices and some devices don't play well. Yeah, and some devices don't play well with others. Thunderbolt is actually remarkably similar in that regard. There are lots of devices that, you know, if you have one in the chain, then things get a little funky downstream. It's all supposed to happen that way, but that's the reality.
But right, like I have a promise.
Sure.
We have this one machine that has a promise RAID on it, so it plugs into a Thunderbolt port, and then there's a pass-through Thunderbolt port, which goes to a single hard drive, and that's the end of the chain. So there's 2 devices on that port. Luckily, that machine has 2 Thunderbolt ports, but if I had to do the same thing, you know, because one the little drive is a backup drive, if I had to do the same thing on both ports, then game over.
It's game over.
I can't go any further. Yeah. Game over, man.
Game over. Yes. So cool. We should probably wrap it up.
I do sort of feel like we didn't achieve what we'd hoped to today.
Well, we spoke for 2.5 hours just on the Mac Pro, and we didn't even get to iOS 7. That's going to be a different show.
It should be. Yeah. And that's going to be interesting.
John, thank you again for joining us. I think we'll definitely have you back for part 2 of this because I want to discuss iOS 7. So do you have any pick for this particular week?
I have a strange pick.
Okay.
A pick that none of us can afford and that we need to find a friend who can. But I am utterly floored by the Tesla.
I was going to say, is it the new Aston Martin?
No, it's the Tesla. It should not be as good as it is.
You're talking the Model S, then?
I'm talking the Model S.
It is a hot f***ing car. In person, actually, I think it's actually less exciting to me because I've driven in it and I've actually driven it. And holy f***, it's cool. But externally, it's actually less exciting than I hoped it would be.
Oh, it's not pretty. It's not like, you know, I want to, it's not like I look at it and
But it looks so cool in the pictures. It looked way cooler in the pictures.
But I think what matters is that it is a fundamental change in the way we think about electric vehicles. I think it's a successful automotive startup in the United States for the first time in heaven knows how many, like 60 years. I don't know what the count is, but it's a very long time. And it's not a Tucker. I mean, there's something, if you can find someone that you know who has one or know somebody who knows who has one or go to take a look at this car, even if you don't ever think you'll buy one, the thinking behind it, the simplicity of it, if you've looked at the demos that they have in the showrooms, there's no parts in this silly thing. It is a remarkable thing in a way that I was truly shocked to discover. So my tidbit for today is if you have not had quality time around a Tesla, go have one. Because even if it means you'll never buy one, there's a lot to be learned about the future of cars and electric vehicles if you look at what they're doing. It's really pretty neat. So that's my thing to show off for today, is to tell you to go look at that, because it's much cooler than the New York Times press thing would have had you believe.
Yeah. So awesome. Boys and girls, go out and buy a Tesla Model S. And so
apparently the buying experience is like Amazon. You configure it all and add to cart, and then you're in debt for the tune to the tune of a house. But
you know, no, under $100,000. You know, the one that's reasonable, you can get for under $100,000, barely under $100,000. But you know, hey, why not? Maggie, how about you?
I want to kind of do something I did before. I want to pimp something on YouTube, but it also has a place on the web as well. I want to pimp the Stan Winston School of Character Arts. If you go to YouTube and you're like me, you get on YouTube and you just end up watching video after video after video, and then you're up till 4 o'clock in the morning.
So many cats. Oh, sorry.
Well, the Stan Winston School has a channel on YouTube with a lot of their free content. It's YouTube user Stan Winston School. It's an amazing resource for learning how they do things. That you can see how they built the full-size T-Rex for Jurassic Park, or you can learn how to create wire rigs, or making a velociraptor suit, or sculpting or things. But also, if you go to stanwinstonschool.com, you can sign up to have access to all of their videos, which are essentially lessons in doing the things that they do, from sculpting using ZBrush, building rigs, making cable rigs, and you know, just anything that goes into designing special effects and particularly special character effects. So it's really amazing, and I'm seriously thinking of paying the money to just do it and start doing some courses there.
That sounds fantastic. That sounds really wild. I would love to check that out. Cool. Lovely.
What about you? What have you got for us?
Yes. Well, I also have a video, although it's not a YouTube video, although it probably will be on YouTube at some point in time. Grew up and cut my teeth. Actually, so my first job was making CD-ROMs for a fairly prominent CD-ROM edutainment company that happened to own rights to a lot of interesting Laserdiscs and now Blu-rays and such. I loved CD-ROM titles. I loved educational games. I loved video games, especially one of the very first Mac-based CD-ROM game, Myst. And
yes.
Robin and Rand Miller, Cyan, created Myst. And if you haven't played it or you haven't heard of it, my gods, where have you been living? It's a fantastic game. It was effectively a slideshow. It was not a full motion video game, but it was on CD-ROM. It featured pre-rendered 3D graphics, absolutely stunning detail, and an immersive story that just was so compelling, you would spend hours and hours and hours exploring these worlds. It was really fantastic. It did incorporate QuickTime and motion video in it as well, which was novel at the time. The entire concept was novel, in fact. And I want to share with you a page from Gamma Sutra, which is the one of the video game websites out there. They actually have a classic post-mortem from the Myst folk from the Game Developers Conference in 2013. They have the full video up there, and it is fantastic. You want to get your learn on in the biggest way watching this video, and it's at a crazy URL, which will be in the show notes. So sorry, there's no possible way I can do this. So I guess that's it. So John, thank you again for joining us. And
it's always good fun.
Indeed. And so we'll have you back on for part two, or we can talk about iOS 7, and we'll have hopefully have another guest as well, so we can have a little bit of a party.
Great. We can't finish the Mac Pro argument?
Oh, God. That is...
We need some more data, I think.
I
was kidding.
I think, yeah.
I'm not.
I'm still arguing with myself about Mac Pro, so there you go.
I think ultimately, I think that the Mac Pro, as it stands, is probably not the Mac Pro for me. But again, I'm not in need of one. So I think that people who may have a 3.1 or a 2.1 and are looking to upgrade, maybe it's worthwhile for them, depending on the price point, of course.
Yeah, I mean, if someone tomorrow said, hey, I want to hire you to occasionally do some grading, and I would like you to, do some modeling for me in whatever, and we're going to pay you a bunch of money, I would be like, okay, I'm going to get a new Mac Pro, because that will be perfect.
Right.
You know?
And it's also the fastest thing out, or will be the fastest thing out there. You know, that still runs the Mac OS legally, right?
Yeah.
So, John, what are your thoughts on the Mac Pro?
I don't know yet, but I'm extremely intrigued. I think a lot will have to do with where it lands from a price perspective. I think there's reason to hope that it won't be absurdly expensive. And I think that Thunderbolt, Thunderbolt 2, and this box may have an interesting effect on the assumptions that we all made when we first talked about this. And it will remain to be seen when it's released, what state Final Cut is in and other tools, whether this is a detour or a fundamental shift in what a design and production workstation really is.
Definitely.
Yeah, totally agree. I mean, just to add to that, like a friend who's, I won't name, but I mean, he was talking about, you know, it's one of those things where if the price point is low enough, they will sell a metric butt ton of these things. If it's a little bit too high, they will still sell some. And of course, this guy was saying, because I expect to kit one out for, you know, it's going to cost me $8,000 and I don't care because he has the money. But, you know, but I think it really does have the potential to be a good machine and to not be. A lot of people are saying, comparing it to the Cube and, oh, it's going to be a failure. I don't think so. I think it is a viable machine, but it definitely carves out its own, the niche of where it fits in. So yeah, I'm really eager to see what it costs. Cool. Apple, do the right thing.
So John, where can we find you?
You can find me in the Twitterverse at @JON_ALPER. If you don't mind my not having looked for weeks at a time, you can find me at the same handle on app.net. You can find my blog at blog.johnalper.com, where a very long post on this very topic is still in the works. And if you have any urge to hire me to help you manage your production infrastructure or your Mac IT, you can reach me at 89system.com.
And Maggie, how about you?
You can also find me in the Twitterverse at TANKGRRL. You can find more about stuff I do at about.me/Maggie McPhee. Or you can also check out my other show, Sci-Fi Idols, at scifiidols.com. There's a new episode coming out soon. It's a little late, but it's about George Lucas. So I really just ended up spending a lot more time in research. So
I still adore your show. I think it's brilliant.
We all do much better work when someone else sets the deadlines.
Yes.
Or at least more timely work, if not
right,
better.
Yeah. Right.
And where can we find you, sir?
You can find me on the Twitterverse, of course. I am at Octothorpe, OctoThorpe. And you can also find Ruining It for Everyone on the Twitters as well, at RI4E, as in the numeral 4. I just realized that we don't pimp our own Twitter handle very often, so we should definitely do that. And let's see, where else can you find me? You can find me on G+ as well, which I think, you know, one of 12 people. yeah, that's about it for now. I think those are the two locations that I'm most often hanging out in these days. So, cool. Let's see, is that it?
I think we're done.
That was another episode of Ruining It for Everyone with your hosts Maggie McPhee and Christopher Harrington. Music provided by Kevin MacLeod. You can find us at ruiningitforeveryone.tv or search for Ruining It for Everyone on iTunes. Be sure to subscribe and rate the show as it really helps us out.
In our tradition of tangents, I have a whole bunch of different accounts for things like everybody does, but I have a different wireless service for my iPad data than I do for my iPhone data. One's Verizon, one's AT&T. And I got a phone call today from Verizon telling me that I needed to pay my bill. And the caller ID didn't say Verizon. And the recording didn't do anything other than tell me that that they knew who I was on that phone number they called. And so they didn't authenticate themselves to me. And right. Then they wanted me to enter payment details on my Touchtone phone.
That's not going to happen.
Exactly. It's just not going to happen. And so the point I'm getting at is that with all this other security thinking and teaching people to use things like 1Password and these ridiculous password rules that make no sense, when there are these gaping holes in the security of the people that we're dealing with, it's surreal.
Right. Yeah, it's the we're the good guys idea. Oh, we're the good guys. It's like, but we don't know you're the good guys.
Oh, and here's your password via email. We need to get a bad idea on the show.
The other sort of telco boneheadedness is that AT&T sent me some communication about my account. It wasn't a billing related one, and they sent it from a domain other than AT&T Wireless.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how is the average user who knew enough to like look at the URLs and their I've turned off HTML because
we've told them to do.
Right.
You know.
Exactly. And yet the domain isn't the same domain as the domain they regularly do business with.
Right. Again, so, it's the, oh, but we're the good guys. No one knows that your intentions.
And now we know all the telcos are decidedly not the good guys. So there's that as well.
Wow, that's breaking news, Christopher.
Yes, it is.
The telcos are not the good guys?
This is not a new show.
I had no idea. Oh, dear. Okay, so anyway, just a little tangent. Sorry about that. We'll get back on topic. And what topic do you want to get back on? Or we want to continue on the tangent.
Maggie, you were about to say something?
Oh, I was just going to mention that I don't know how to say it.
Oh, well. Oh, you don't know? Oh.
Somebody released a new computer. Well, they didn't release it. They
well, okay. So, okay, we can.
So let's talk about the new Asus.
It looks pretty hot. It looks a lot like a MacBook Air, but other than that, I think it's really hot.